Hey, this is Jess. You're listening to Offshore. This is episode 4 of our first season, A Killing in Waikiki. If you haven't heard the previous episodes, you should go back and listen to those first. Everything is going to make a lot more sense if you listen to the stories in order.
We're on our way to find the grave of Joseph Ka'awai, and as you can see, there's no set paths in this cemetery, so make sure we don't walk on some graves.
I'm with Nanette Napoleon. She's a historian. Around Oahu, she's known as the Cemetery Lady.
And here we are. I kind of made it my mission to hanai his grave and help take care of it over the years. Hanai means adopt, take in, and take care of. Usually in terms of people, you hanai a person, right? But in this case, I've hanaied his grave.
The graveyard we're in is called Puea Cemetery. It's creepy. It looks practically abandoned. There's dry brown grass that grows past your knees. No aisles or rows. No real way of knowing if you're walking on a sunken grave. But Joseph Ka'awai's grave is different.
Joseph's grave has a nice little white picket fence, which was not always here. It's relatively new. And then the marker itself, at the top, it has a crown, which is the crown of God.
People have cleaned up his marker, stood it up straight.
Below that, it says, at rest.
There are plastic flowers spread around, a blue and white lei draped over it.
And then below that, it says, Joseph Ka'awai Jr., born December 25th, 1909. And what's unusual about the next line is, doesn't say died, it says killed. Killed January 8th, 1932.
I'm Jessica Terrell from Honolulu Civil Beat and PRX. This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. When Christopher Didi killed Colin Eldertz, it was like a ghost rose up from this graveyard. It came out of this grave right here and leapt into the consciousness of people all over Hawaii. We've heard these names before, Ka'awai and Massey. They stand out in the memories of many Native Hawaiians, the way the names like Emmett Till, Rodney King, or Trayvon Martin might stand out on the mainland.
Do you ever talk to his grave?
Not out loud, but I relive the story and I try to remember his story. Even when I'm here all by myself, I go through the whole story because it's important to me.
In 1932, the names Ka'awai and Massey were splashed across newspapers in 4-inch type. The Associated Press called it the story of the year, bigger than Amelia Earhart's transatlantic flight and the Lindbergh baby. But today, this case, the murder, and what they mean, mostly forgotten. Mostly.
Like, and I'm talking to you, I'm getting emotional, right, about telling this story.
What emotions?
Anger and just a sense of injustice. How could such a thing happen when the evidence, the way it transpired, and all of the things that led up to his death were mind-boggling, hard to believe that such a thing can happen. And to this day, when people hear the story, they're going, are you kidding me? How can that have happened, right? But it did. And it still remains this story that you just can't believe, right, that it happened.
September 12th, 1931. This story starts on a night very similar to the night Christopher Didi shot Colin Eldertz in Waikiki. Take away the skyrise hotels, most of the restaurants, the bars. Waikiki in the 1930s looks very different. And yet, beneath the surface, the place is surprisingly familiar. It's a hot weekend, and people are out for a good time. Tourists, military, locals. Ringing a bell? But there are 4 people out partying tonight that we're going to pay particular attention to. A Howley couple and 2 local guys. The Howleys are military, Tommy and Thalia Massey, a young couple from back east. And they look and act kind of like they belong in an F. Scott Fitzgerald story. The locals are 2 Native Hawaiians named Joe Ka'awai and Ben Ahakuelo. They're boxers in their early 20s. And what happens when these 4 meet? Well, Let's just say there are a lot of reasons why when Christopher Deedy killed Colin Eldredge, people immediately thought of this night in 1931. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about Hawaii in the 1930s.
Hawaii, melting pot of the Pacific.
This is an NBC radio show about Hawaii from World War II. It was trying to help Americans understand Hawaii, a very remote territory with a very big military base.
In the 166 years since Captain Cook discovered the Hawaiian Islands, men of all creeds and colors and races have migrated to this melting pot of the Pacific.
White people have been obsessed with race in Hawaii pretty much since Captain Cook. And this seems like as good a time as any to point out that European contact went about as well for Native Hawaiians as it did for most other indigenous groups around the world.
In 1778, there were 300,000 Hawaiians in the islands. Today, there are less than 15,000 pure Hawaiians.
And Hawaiian culture, despite its ancient language, scientific and technological understanding, has always been stereotyped as simple and superstitious.
Could you tell us a little more?
Long ago, before the great Kamehameha.
This is the Brady Bunch in Hawaii in 1972. You know, that wholesome family so many Americans grew up with. They go to Hawaii and run into a big, bad, ancient curse that almost destroys them. Happens all the time, right?
Evil come to those who touch. It will always come, my children, until idol is put back.
And here's Adam Sandler in a stupid rom-com from 2004.
Okay, you guys, thanks for coming to say goodbye.
Rob Schneider plays as close to a Hawaiian Sambo as you'll ever see.
Honore, onu ai, kahana oi, nahelane.
Thank you, buddy. What does that mean again?
Bring me back a t-shirt.
Then there was the Cameron Crowe movie last year, where a Caucasian actress played a half-Hawaiian, half-Chinese woman. And you've probably seen the ads for Disney's Moana.
Kakamora.
Kaka what?
Blow dart in my butt cheek.
Need I say more? But back to the 20s and 30s. Even back then, before jet airplanes, Hawaii was becoming an exotic tourist destination. Tourism ads in mainland magazines highlighted the white sand beaches and laid-back luaus. The Royal Hawaiian Hotel opened in 1927. The other thing Hawaii was known for? The military. The U.S. established a major base here in 1899. By 1930, it was massive. Hawaii wasn't a state yet, and Congress and the Navy, they had a big interest in keeping the local population under control. A local population that behaved a lot differently than Jim Crow-era mainlanders were used to.
In the fall of 1931...
This is John Rosa. He's a history professor at the University of Hawaii.
We have to remind ourselves, it's still the times of the Great Depression. People are having very difficult economic times.
Potential war with Japan looming.
And this is David Stannard. He also teaches at the University of Hawaii, and he wrote a book called Honor Killing about what's known as the Massey case.
The military is really beefing up in preparation for that.
A vast majority of the personnel here in the 30s are actually from the American South.
The 100% racially segregated South.
There was a new kind of racism that came with the military.
These guys couldn't stand seeing people of all races mixing it up in the hotels, the restaurants, the bars, and especially on the beach.
The idea of going to the beach and watching young Hawaiian men massaging white women and teaching them how to surf and swim and so on and so forth was absolutely intolerable.
And when you have a force that's as powerful as the Navy and it's staffed with all these racist people, you can imagine at some point that's going to boil over.
And it's interesting because the wealthier whites who came during that time, they were attracted by this. It was part of the lure of this very special Blessed Isles kind of place. But the military, which was now massive in terms of its size in Hawaii at that time, was staffed from top to bottom with people who were really very, very unhappy with the situation they saw around them. These people came and they hated. They hated the idea that they were going to go on a beach and with these dark-skinned people who were Hawaiians in Hawaii. And that, of course, included Tommy Massey and his friends.
We've got to talk a little bit about Tommy and Thalia Massey, the Fitzgerald-esque couple I mentioned earlier. Tommy Massey came from a middle-class family in Kentucky, but his wife Thalia, she was the real piece of work. If white privilege had been a phrase or a concept people talked about in the 1930s, they probably would have pointed to Thalia Massey.
Thalia came from a family that was very privileged and yet poor, but nobody knew they were poor.
Thalia's father was a first cousin and bosom buddy of Teddy Roosevelt. Yes, the former president. Her mother was attached to the Bell fortune, as in Alexander Graham. Picture Thalia Massey's family as American aristocrats who just hadn't inherited the cash to go along with their society titles. And while Thalia's parents were often broke, they used these family connections to raise their kids in relative opulence. They stayed at family estates, used their social connections to secure lines of credit. But Thalia, she didn't exactly have big prospects for her future.
She was married when she was really young.
This is DeSoto Brown, the archivist at Honolulu's Bishop Museum.
I think he was 20 and she was 16 when they got married.
The summer Thalia and Tommy Massey started dating, Thalia and her family were crashing at the Long Island estate of the Roosevelts. And the sorts of things the young couple did together that summer, well, they say a lot.
One day they went in and tried to make to be a poor person, so they got dressed up in poor people's clothes and they sold pencils on the street corner. Who knows what that was about?
And then there was the night they kidnapped a baby. They kidnapped a baby. Why would you kidnap a baby?
For fun.
For fun.
They took the baby and hid it someplace.
The baby's parents were, you know, upset.
They called the police and they were, needless to say, frantic. And there was Tommy and Thalia with the baby someplace hiding to play a little joke on them. They were arrested. And as soon as the judge saw who it was, Thalia, he dismissed the case as a prank and let it go.
Thalia, a.k.a. Teddy Roosevelt's cousin, was pulling a harmless prank.
That's the kind of thing that they could do and get away with. There were just simply no consequences.
And they carry this privileged and reckless attitude with them to Hawaii. Tommy Massey was a lieutenant in the Navy when he and Thalia arrive in Honolulu. They're excited. Hawaii is the new place to be.
This was paradise. It was being played out in travel magazines and all over the country. In the 1920s, Hawaii was the new great place to go.
Pack up your troubles and come along. Well, life's a dreamy and life's a song. In Honolulu, across the sea, making wiki-wacky down in Waikiki.
But there's a problem. Tommy's assigned to a submarine, which means days and weeks away at a time. And 20-year-old Thalia, she did not like being alone. When he was home, they were both drinking heavily, fighting a lot.
She was bored, according to their live-in maid. She began having affairs with other Navy men and so on and so forth. And would flaunt them in front of Tommy and in quite openly at parties as well.
Which might have been what she was doing on the night that kicks off the Massey case, September 12th, 1931. Here's John Rosa picking up the story.
Thalia Massey and her husband and a number of other people in a Navy circle, they go to Waikiki, actually near the Alawai, and they go to a speakeasy of sorts. This is the era of prohibition where under federal law, alcohol is illegal, but it's really easy to get to.
Tommy and Thalia head for a local spot that's reserved for military officers on Saturday nights. They may as well have put a whites-only sign on the door.
The only person of color there was the doorman. Who was Portuguese, so he's not really a person of color.
By all accounts, they were having a good time at first, drinking, dancing. But then things between Tommy and Thalia start to get heated.
She had an argument with the people she was with, and she left without telling anybody and then walked down the street.
Apparently this was something Thalia did a lot. Stormed out of parties, left her husband behind. And that's probably why nobody thought much of it at first.
That night, there was no moon. It was pitch dark. It was in the city, but it was there were no buildings around to cast any light and so on.
It's just a paved road, and there are just trees, shrubs, there's a date palm, and maybe a few little houses that you can see.
She goes down toward the ocean, and it's there that she's allegedly abducted.
Thalia said she left the party sometime between 11:35 p.m. and midnight. At 12:50, she flags down a car full of civilians on a road less than half a mile from the club.
And the first thing she says when she gets picked up is, "Are you white people?"
The people who pick her up notice that her face is pretty swollen, and they're alarmed when Thalia tells them that she's been abducted by a group of Hawaiians. First she says 2, then 4, then 5. Her story keeps changing. They want to drive her to the police, to a hospital, but Thalia says no. Just take me home. Just take me home. When Tommy gets home, she tells him that she's not only been kidnapped, she's been raped. Multiple times. But she still doesn't want to go to the police. He ignores her and makes the call.
When she was examined at the hospital, she didn't have any physical evidence that she had been raped. However, she had bruises on her face. At the very, very least, we do know that she was attacked or beaten by someone. Her jaw was broken so badly it had to be wired shut.
The police came and the detectives asked her, do you know what kind of car it was? Do you know the license plate?
She says that there were 5 or 6 individuals. She thinks that they were Hawaiian. She did not see their faces. She has a vague description of the car, and she does not have a license plate number.
Meanwhile, at those same moments, Joseph Kahawai and Ben Ahakuelo, the Native Hawaiian guys you want to pay attention to in this episode, are out in Waikiki having a good time with 3 friends.
They had gone to a party, 2 parties, and a luau all around in the Honolulu area.
This is Nanette Napoleon again, the cemetery lady.
And coincidentally, late in the evening, they got into a fender bender with another car.
They were actually in Waikiki at the Waikiki Amusement Park, enjoying a dance.
Like a lot of young Native Hawaiian men in the Great Depression, Kahawai and Ahakuelo are a bit adrift in life. They live in a neighborhood called Hell's Half Acre, one of the poorest and roughest neighborhoods in Hawaii. They both box, but it's not a sport with lots of money attached to it. Work is hard to come by. Nights out are probably rare. And they're out that night with
2 Japanese, local Japanese, David Takai and Horace Ida. And last but not least, Henry Chang, who is half Hawaiian, half Chinese, and we really don't know too much about him.
Then, at 12:35 a.m., after a long night of drinking, Kahawai and his friends are driving through Waikiki when they slam on the brakes. They barely miss another car, driven by a white man named Homer Peoples, with his wife Agnes and a couple of friends. Kahawai and his friends jump out. They're mad and drunk. Kahawai yells at Homer, calling him a damn howley. Get out of your car.
Words are exchanged. There's shoving. Next thing you know, Joseph Kahawai, a boxer at that, just decks Agnes Peoples.
It was near Ala Moana, so kind of close to where Thalia had said she was raped, but not that close.
Both get into their cars, they go away, but Agnes Peoples and her husband actually report this to the police. The police, for the better part of 2 to 3 hours, are actually broadcasting on police radios. The license plate number of the car that Horace Ida and Joseph Kahawai are in.
2Y Young 3146.
Cut back over to Tommy and Thalia Massey's house. The police park a car outside for the night, and the officers inside leave the radio on. A radio loudly broadcasting over and over again the license plate number of a car driven by 5 local men.
Coincidentally, after that happened, she changes her story. Yes, I remember the license of the car.
When the sun comes up, she is able to provide a license plate number.
And the number she provides is the number of the car Kahawai and his friends were driving. The license number she'd probably heard broadcast all night outside her door.
And so they found them all. Even though their stories checked out, they rounded them up and they took them to the police station and charged them with the kidnapping of Thalia Massey and possibly rape.
I mean, it was a lie. It was a lie. She participated in a lie.
The only known photo of Joseph Kahawai is his mugshot, taken early in the morning of September 13th, 1931. The photo's black and white, a little fuzzy around the edges. He's a good-looking guy, square jaw, short kind of wavy hair. He's staring very intensely at the camera. The mugshots of his friends, they're all serious, but look a little scared, startled, distressed. Kahawai, it's not fair to interpret his look as angry, but let's just say he has the look of a man who's not going to back down. Unflinching. Unintimidated. Turns out none of the 5 friends are easily intimidated. Detectives separate them, threaten them, entice them with rewards. Nobody's story changes. They were out drinking. They were together the whole night. They've never seen that quote-unquote Howley woman before. Nothing they say matters, though. Detectives, prosecutors, Navy officials, they all have their minds made up about what happened that night.
There are major problems with the case before it gets to the trial.
The first problem is Thalia's story. It changes frequently, and it just doesn't match up with the facts. The timing's hazy. At first, she describes a car that's totally different from the car the men were driving. Then she changes her description of the men. She describes the area where she was violently raped, but there's nothing there that indicates any kind of struggle ever happened. And then there's this one fact about Thalia Massey that nobody brings up at the trial, which is totally insane to me.
And she was essentially blind, legally blind. She did wear glasses, but she didn't wear them that night. It was pitch dark. She couldn't possibly have seen them to identify them.
There were also witnesses who saw Thalia that night, saw her walking along the dark street, saw her being followed by a tall white man. So obviously not five Hawaiian men. But the biggest piece of evidence, the reason historians and private investigators and even the Pinkerton Agency would later say that there is absolutely no way that Kahawai and his friends could have raped and kidnapped Thalia Massey.
The window was only about an hour that that this could have happened, and they were seen in a completely miles away, another part of town throughout this whole thing. So it was simply physically impossible for them to have been there at that time. You can't be in two places at once, and they were clearly nowhere near the scene of the crime.
Of course, that doesn't mean Thalia wasn't attacked or even raped by someone else. Nobody really knows what happened to her. But we can say with certainty it had nothing to do with Kahawai and his friends.
Whether she was beaten by locals or Native Hawaiians or maybe somebody in the Navy who was a friend or a lover or even her own husband, we've never been able to be sure. And I often call her the first victim of the case. She's never able to really prove that she was raped. And often after the fact, she doesn't get a chance to speak for herself. She's spoken for by her mother or by members of the military. So exactly what happened to Thalia Massey and her body, we're not entirely sure.
Because in all of this, Thalia didn't matter. What mattered was that brown men were accused of raping a white woman. And there was going to be hell to pay.
So once the case went to trial, it went very quickly.
Actually, by today's standards, the whole process, including the investigation, went incredibly quickly. The trial started in November, just 2 months after the men were arrested. For a little modern-day comparison here, Brock Turner, the Stanford student convicted of assaulting an unconscious woman behind the dumpster, the guy who's been all over the news in the last year, he was arrested in January 2015. His trial didn't begin until March of 2016, more than 15 months after the assault. But in 1931, there was a whole lot of pressure in Hawaii to get the rape case over with quickly, to get a conviction quickly.
Both territorial officials and U.S. Navy officials here in Hawaii want to have as little outside news coverage as possible.
They're worried about the impact a story like this might have on tourism, on military morale, on the future of Hawaii.
The real concern is actually that Hawaii as a territory might not ever achieve statehood.
The last thing any of them wanted was a case like this getting away. They wanted prosecution fast. So they frankly just manufactured evidence.
Kahawai and Ahakuelo and their friends, they know they're in serious trouble here. It takes them almost a month to get the money together to post bail. And the whole time they're in jail, local newspapers are publishing outrageous, one-sided stories about their guilt. The white business community posts a $5,000 reward for evidence that can assist prosecutors. So Ahakuelo's mom turns to the one person she thinks can help. She reaches out to royalty, Hawaiian royalty. Princess Abigail Kuananakoa. She's the woman who would have been the Queen of Hawaii in 1932 if the monarchy hadn't been overthrown by American businessmen 4 decades earlier.
She was approached by the mother of one of the accused young men. While she was preparing for this fabulous dinner she was having for the king and queen of Siam, she said, all right, I'll see if I can find some attorneys that will represent your son and his friends.
The princess convinces a lawyer named William Heen to take up the case. Heen is Chinese Hawaiian. He understands the challenges facing these guys in court. So Heen does something kind of brilliant.
So he hired this guy from Mississippi, who a big draw looks just like something right out of Central Casting. And he became the most ferocious accuser of the white power structure and the Howleys and this and that and so forth during the trial.
The police in this case are doing crazy things, like hot-wiring the car that Kahawai and his friends were driving that night and taking it to the spot where Thalia Massey said she was assaulted, and then logging those tire tracks as evidence of the rape. When they type up the interrogations of the accused men, they add in details that the men never said, probably assuming the men will sign the statements without reading them first. Anything they can do to secure a conviction. The first day of the trial is November 16th, and the courthouse is overflowing. Hawaii's wealthy are so interested in this case that they have servants go down to the courthouse in the morning to hold seats. The first witness is Thalia Massey. Suddenly, she has an amazingly clear memory of the accused men. She's able to describe tiny details of their clothing and appearance that would be really hard to notice on a dark night, even if you weren't legally blind. The kind of details, by the way, that are clearly written in the evidence logs that the prosecution has in its possession. So yeah, talk about prepping the witness. When the defense gets its turn with Thalia, they start asking her some tough questions, and all of a sudden, she can't remember anything. But the daily newspapers, they don't note her inconsistencies. They write about how she's such a beautiful and sorrowful woman. The defense lawyers show that Thalia Massey's story is inconsistent, that the timeline just doesn't match up.
They called all different kinds of witnesses. There were witnesses that said they saw Thalia Massey walking down the street on Hobron Lane, which was several blocks from where she left her husband. So it was kind of a distance away. And
it's probably worth mentioning here that while the big dailies in Hawaii are really slanted against Kahawai and the accused men, there's a small Japanese-owned paper doing real journalism, questioning the evidence, picking apart the investigation. And so there begins to be this split in Hawaii over the case, with a lot of the Japanese community and the Hawaiian community believing in the men. While a lot, though certainly not all of the Howleys, are out for blood. And the defense lawyers, they don't just accuse the cops of doing shoddy police work. They come right out and say, these guys are being totally framed. Pittman, the defense lawyer from Mississippi, gives a fiery closing statement where he tells the jurors, if you convict them, you have got to have no conscience. You've got to have no soul. You've got to be cowardly. The prosecutor, in the meantime, hammers away again and again at the horror of rape in a way that's so totally over the top, it's hard to imagine in a courtroom today. The prosecutor says, quote, death is preferable to such an assault as was perpetrated. Mrs. Massey is better off dead than to go through life in the condition she was left in by these lust-sodden beasts. And she knows it.
Observers in the courtroom could see that the jury members were looking into the audience, and it seemed as if audience members, employers, were telling the jury with their eyes that this verdict should go in a certain way, convicting the local young men very quickly so that all of this is done away with and that the territory of Hawaii at large can escape scrutiny.
The trial lasts about 2 weeks. Then the jury deliberates for 4 days, collects more than 100 ballots.
The jury members know that their own jobs are at stake if they do not produce a verdict that is amenable to the power structure in Hawaii.
In fact, the pressure to get a guilty verdict is so intense that jurors get into fist fights with each other. They keep saying, we can't reach a consensus, and the judge keeps sending them back. A tactic he admits later on was to try and get a guilty verdict. Despite all this pressure, the jury just can't do it. They can't bring themselves to convict. But they can't let these men walk away either.
And the jury split.
The first trial ends in a mistrial.
It was a mixed racial jury, and it did not break along racial lines.
And then everybody goes crazy. Thank you. Navy and local officials may have been successful in keeping the case out of mainland newspapers at first. But after the mistrial, the press goes wild. National newspapers run illustrations of ghoulish-looking Hawaiians holding young white women by the scruff of the neck. They run articles with outrageous claims about white women being raped in Hawaii. 40 in the last year, they say. Though there hadn't actually been a single reported case. Time magazine writes, quote, "Yellow men's lust for white women had broken bounds."
It was the antithesis of all of that really happy advertising of Hawaii as paradise. It was instead the Hawaiian Islands, it's all a lie, it's a facade. They're actually crawling with evil, dark-skinned men who want to ravage pure white women who are held in their clutches. I mean, and this may sound ridiculous when I'm putting it that way, but that literally is what people were saying.
In Honolulu, enlisted men carry containers of aviation fuel into downtown to set it on fire, but back out at the last minute. One drunken sailor drives around town in a car with a bunch of machine guns mounted on it and tells people he's part of a planned invasion. A few days after the trial ends, a group of sailors kidnap Horace Ida at gunpoint. He's one of the five accused. They take him to a remote cliff and beat him with belts and straps until he collapses. How does the Navy commander respond? With pride at how restrained his sailors are. After all, they didn't kill Ida. It's not hard to find Kahawai and his friends. They're required to go to the courthouse every day. And that's what Joseph Kahawai does on January 8th, 1942.
So it's on the steps here that Joseph Kahawai comes up here to check in. And that's when he's actually enticed away toward a car with a fake summons, pushed into the car, and that's how Joseph Kahawai is kidnapped.
This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. In the wake of the rape trial, Navy officers are out for blood. And the injustice of what is known as the Massey case, the reason why it lives on in the minds of Native Hawaiians to this day, the reason why people were so convinced, even before Christopher Didi's trial began, that he would never be punished for Colin Eldert's death. Well, we haven't even gotten to that part yet. That's next week on Offshore. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat at civilbeat.org. Civil Beat is a nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the real Hawaii. Offshore is distributed by PRX. Offshore's producer and executive producer is Ben Adair. Our editor is Patty Epler. April Estralon is our assistant producer. I'll be back next week.